So my name's John. I'm an MD-PhD student at the University of Miami in Miami, Florida. And I'm presenting a topic for which I had a sort of like an MD-PhD fellowship for basically almost like dissertation grants. So I'm still technically a student. I'm in my last year of medical school and completed my PhD about a year and a half ago. And so this is sort of related to, not exactly my dissertation, but sort of part of this project that I was able to receive funding for from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. So it's entitled Exposure to Ambient Air Particulate Matter 2.5, or Fine Particulate Matter, Significant Mechanism Exposure to Polycyclic Aromatic Hydrocarbons in the U.S. Population. So it'll take me a few minutes in order to explain things so you can understand my title in the first place if you're not too familiar with all of them. But I'll go ahead and get started. So just as I'm sure everybody has to do with your presentations, we just have to discuss our conflicts of interest, anything like that. So I have no personal or financial relationship with anything involved in my presentation and nothing to disclose to anybody. Just a little bit of overview. So for people that don't know what polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are, they're basically just organic compounds that are produced from the incomplete combustion of organic material. And so this can come from a variety of different places, such as tobacco, coal, and petroleum. And they're believed to be environmental carcinogens, and that has been shown in a variety of different basic science environments. And you can, again, we'll talk a little bit about how people are exposed to these things. But one of those routes is environmental air pollution. And that's really what was the focus of my research project. But it is somewhat complicated because there are a variety of different types of exposures. And so I'll go into a little bit about the other types of exposures. So they are a component in ambient air particulate matter, air pollution, and specifically PM2.5. And we'll talk a little bit about more sort of like how people are exposed, but we'll get into that in a second. So if you're here, you're probably all aware that ambient air pollution is a risk factor for certain human diseases. And historically, the research on the health effects of ambient air particulate matter have been focused on sort of like acute health events. So a lot of the research in the past has been about changes in air quality, and for example, admissions to emergency departments due to MIs or other types of disease. So that's what's been researched in the past, but what got us thinking was sort of, or at least with our type of data, there was sort of need for more mechanistic research, sort of what is it within the ambient air pollution that might be contributing to these adverse health events. And so the group that we focused on, just because of the data that we had available to us, was polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. So trying to sort of investigate what is it specifically within the pollution that might be causing these effects. So I'm going to just go a little bit more detail about the types of exposures, and this is to polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, that's how I'll refer to them. Humans are exposed to them in a variety of different ways, and historically it's mostly just been either environmental or occupational. I'd say the first research and the sort of most sort of thorough research has been specifically within the occupational exposures, because those are these exposures or the environments in which people are exposed to the highest levels of these. You can see like coke plants, smelting, things like that, where you actually have very high temperatures that are produced in order to create these combustion products of organic materials. And so there have been a variety of different studies on or at least exposure measurement, exposure assessment in occupational groups for the PAHs. But there also there's a variety of different types of exposures just in the day-to-day environment. Obviously, on average, at a much lower dose, at a much lower exposure than these occupational settings. So anything from, tobacco smoking, and even like a classic exposure is sort of char-grilled meat. You'll get it through your absorption by your gut, So not only is it a matter of like the doses in which these compounds are produced, but also the way in which humans are exposed to them. And based on, we'll talk a little bit about some of their chemistry in a second, but as we said, you can get them from inhalation exposure, at least in general with air pollution, and that, when that's been discussed, it's been primarily through inhalation. Certain occupational groups can have dermal exposures, either in a variety of different industrial processes, airplane fuel and like airports and places like that. You can get them from dermal exposures, and then, as I said just a second ago, and some in our diet, from like burnt food and things like that. So those are the different types of ways or the routes in which people can be exposed. And so these compounds, I don't really have any pictures of any of the specific organic molecules, but depending on their sort of physical chemistry, that can affect the way in which and the route in which humans are exposed to them. So specifically very low molecular weight ones, they're found much more often or in a greater percentage in a gaseous phase. So in general, that would make a lot more sense that if you're exposed by inhalation, that's the way in which you might be exposed to these low molecular weight ones. And as you go from low molecular weight to higher molecular weight, the proportion in which they're found and they're because of their physical properties in the environment goes from gas to particulate phase, so solid phase. And so some of the different PAHs have been associated with the different routes of exposure because of their physical chemistry. So for example, tobacco smoke, if you think about it, you're having some organic material that's being combusted really close to your face. You're gonna there have been associations with some of the gaseous phase PAHs, and at least in biomonitoring studies, you'll get a large proportion of your exposure to these lower molecular weight PAHs because they're able to be found in the gaseous phase. And then other things like air pollution and some of the other industrial processes are PAHs that their physical properties, lead them to be more in a solid phase or a particulate phase. And so that affects their route of exposure and the dose in which humans are exposed to them. So one past study from 2002, it sort of showed the proportion in which people are exposed to them between the gaseous phase and the particulate phase. And the PAHs, whose names you really can't see very well on the far left, those are the lower molecular weight PAHs. So those are the ones that are more able to be found in a gaseous phase. And so the light blue bar is their gas phase. And so in the environment, and this is in ambient air pollution, in the environment, it's the low molecular weight PAHs that are found in a gaseous phase. And that's the route in which humans are usually exposed to them. And on the right side, these are higher molecular weight PAHs that are found predominantly in a particulate matter phase. And so you can see how there would be differences in the routes of human exposure to them depending on their physical properties. But in general, if you're able to produce PAHs, again, they're usually produced by the combustion of organic products, you're not just getting one PAH that's produced. So, for example, this is a distribution from ambient air pollution. So you can see there are a variety of different PAHs because it does consist of many different types of compounds, all of which we don't necessarily know all the health effects of each individual one. But in general, they're sort of believed to be sort of have the same types of health effects. Again, they're known carcinogens and have been hypothesized to be involved in other types of adverse health events like cardiovascular disease and things like that. But in general, usually humans are exposed to them in groups rather than just individual PAHs. So what my project was and what I was funded to do was to actually link data between the CDC and the EPA. So I'll talk a little bit about exactly what that data was. So the CDC data was specifically within the NHANES, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, between 2001 and 2004. And the data in which we have are actually biomarkers of human exposure to PAHs. So the urinary samples, and starting in around 1999, the NHANES incorporated a variety of different environmental or biomarkers of environmental exposure to different toxins. So it's a large group of data that NHANES has, and one of those sort of subgroups were PAHs. So there are, I believe it's about 10 different individual PAHs that they have urinary biomarkers for within NHANES. And so my data specifically was between 2001 to 2004. And then the EPA data, EPA, you know, collects a lot of data across the nation, specifically about air quality levels and a variety of different types of measures of that. And one of those was particulate matter, which again is known to have PAHs in it. And so we wanted to basically start investigating whether or not air pollution, or at least particulate matter 2.5 levels in the environment, is in any way associated with individuals' biomarkers of PAHs. So it's sort of trying to, you know, get a sort of a direct link between what's seen in the environment and then what levels you can actually detect in individuals. So that was sort of the thought behind ours. And so there have been past linkages between NHANES data and EPA data, and so we were just sort of piggybacking on past research from people at the National Center for Health Statistics that have been able to do these linkages in the past. And in order to be able to do this, you have to also do it through the CDC at what's called the Research Data Center, which is the organization that houses or basically manages the NHANES data. And in order to be able to do this linkage, you have to have personal identifiers, or specifically where people live, in order to link the EPA data, you know, in order to identify where somebody lives, in order to be able to link the data with their environment, with the PM2.5 levels in their environment, to the individuals in a specific area. So that was really what we had to do. And then the NHANES sample, again, it's a two-year data collection survey, and it has a variety of different things. As I said before, in 1999, they started measuring environmental, or at least biomarkers of exposure to environmental compounds, of which PAHs are a subset. And they also have, you know, if you know NHANES data at all, there's just a flood of data. They have survey data, so self-report data of anything. Again, it was originally designed for, you know, even nutrition is in the name, so, you know, variety of different nutritional information, as well as physical examination data, laboratory data. It's just a huge amount of data that they have. And then for the PAH biomarkers, the ones that we have available for analysis are based on four, what are in general are considered low molecular weight PAHs. So even though there is some variation between these four in terms of their molecular weight, there is some variation also in their physical properties. Whereas, so the naphthalene, which is the first one listed here, in general that's found in a gaseous phase. Whereas the later one, specifically pyrene, which is the one that has had the most research in terms of human exposure, that's found at a greater percentage in a particulate phase, which was shown in that previous slide. So even though these are in general are pretty much low molecular weight, there at least is some variation in the physical properties of them, and thus affecting the routes in which humans are exposed to them. And then for our analysis, we also included other variables from NHANES that we had specifically, or most importantly, I'd say tobacco smoke exposure, because that is probably the most significant high-level exposure or route of high-level exposure to PAHs in the population. That may not necessarily be true in certain occupation groups that are exposed to very high levels of PAHs, but at least within the population, there's been a variety of different past research on the importance of, or at least the role of tobacco smoke exposure and biomarkers of PAH exposure. So with the EPA data we had, It's collected from state, local, and tribal agencies that basically submit these levels of individual air pollution markers or measures to the EPA. And what we were able to do is we were able to assign each respondent within the NHANES data based on our data linkage to either the same county or at least county measures of air pollution levels, as well as sort of physical distance from these EPA mark, these sort of monitors, air pollution monitors that EPA has. So we're only able to do, again, here we have county 5 miles and 10 miles from the NHANES participants' place of residence. So again, there are obviously some limitations based on this. Specifically, it's a very large area. Even 5 miles, you could think is there's going to be a lot of variation in the levels of air pollution or levels of PM2.5 within 5 miles of somebody's house, but that's basically the best we could do based on our data. So we'll talk a little bit about that later. So for our analysis, again, what our real goal was to sort of see whether or not there are any associations between environmental measures of air pollution, again, PM 2.5, and individuals' levels of PAH biomarker levels. And so we did this. We specifically limited it to people that are 20 years and older because there have been some past research that suggests that there is variation in biomarker levels depending on an individual's age. Specifically, children have because of their inherent metabolism of PAHs, there is a large variation in their biomarker levels. So we limited it to a, sort of a group that has a relatively stable metabolism of PAHs. So that's why we limited it to people 20 years and older. And then we also we're trying to make these associations with PM 2.5 levels either on the day of their NHANES laboratory draws or the day before. And what we ended up doing was a sensitivity analysis to see if we could find associations or there a variation in these associations dependent on either the day in which we did a linkage with the particulate matter levels, either the same day or prior day, as well as the radius around a person's place of residence. So either the county, the 5 mile or the 10 mile radius around their place of residence. And in the end, we ended up finding out that that the strongest associations were seen between a person's prior day exposure or the levels, the PM 2.5 levels of the day before their NHANES participation, as well as within 5 miles of their place of residence, which makes a lot of sense, just knowing the mechanism of metabolism for the PAHs. They're, in general, you know, there's a variety of different half-lives with these biomarkers of PAH exposure, but at least you would expect them to be exposed to, or at least their biomarker levels to sort of react based on their previous or prior day levels of exposure to PM 2.5. And then we investigate associations between these different, between air pollution levels and individuals' levels to PAH biomarkers. And so I apologize for some, maybe pretty hard to see some of these tables, but I'm just basically going to say what's important from these individual tables that we created. But what we first did was wanted to compare whether or not the people that were able to be linked in our data set, in this data linkage, to the general NHANES population. So, or at least the population of people 20 years and older that had these PAH biomarkers measured, we wanted to see whether or not the people that were able to be linked were significantly different from the people that NHANES collected data on. And there were some slight differences specifically in race and education, which may play a role in some of the results that may be taken from this. But in general, there weren't huge differences in the population that we were able to have a data linkage with and the general NHANES population that was able to have PAH biomarkers measured on. So we weren't too worried about there to be differences, or at least that this population that we were investigating with the NHANES population in general. So the first sort of simple analysis that we wanted to perform was to see whether or not there were any correlations between the levels of PM 2.5 in a person's place of residence and their biomarker levels of each individual PAHs. So again, we have multiple biomarkers of PAH exposure, specifically of individual PAHs. And so what we first wanted to do was to break it out based on smokers and non-smokers, because again, tobacco smoke exposures within the population is probably one of the most important routes of exposure to for PAHs. So we wanted to look at specifically smokers and non-smokers, and we did see in general, at least for each of the individual PAHs, that there were at least positive correlations between a person's PM 2.5 level exposure and their biomarker levels of PAHs, although they're very weak associations. So, there were some differences for smokers and non-smokers, at least and with the non-smokers there were some more statistically significant results, but in general that's most likely because of just having large samples. At least we had about 520 non-smokers that were able to be, we were able to perform these analyses on. But in general, we at least saw consistent positive associations, which is at least a sign that there may be some link between your exposure to air pollution and these biomarkers of exposure to PAHs. The next one we did was basically to try to create multiple regression models that incorporated other variables so that it was able to incorporate tobacco smoke exposure. But even more than that, also trying in this multiple regression model, we want to incorporate markers of exposure to secondhand smoke as well. because it would make sense that if you're being a smoker, it's a significant exposure. If you actually have exposure to secondhand smoke, whether or not this may affect it as well. So we ended up creating multiple regression models, and we sort of found the same results as well, that there were small yet positive associations, positive correlations between levels of environmental exposure to PM2.5 and individuals' levels of PAH biomarkers. And then the last sort of analysis that we felt was most worthwhile doing was basically trying to sort of identify people that live in, or at least the day in which we measured their PM2.5 levels, whether or not we could identify differences between people that lived in, or at least were in, areas that had very high levels of PM2.5. So there is an air quality standard that was established in 2006 that basically identified sort of an unhealthy level of PM2.5, and we wanted to see whether or not that would be associated with increased levels of PAH biomarkers. And sure enough, at least out of these eight PAHs, or at least PAH biomarkers that we measured, for people that lived in this high level of PM2.5, or at least areas that had high levels of PM2.5 air pollution, we saw consistently high levels of PAH biomarkers. And the range varied. There was only one PAH that whose geometric mean level was lower in the geographic area with high levels of air pollution. But for all the others, and specifically the one that's at the very bottom, so this one's called 1-hydroxypyrene, and so at the very bottom of this table. But in general, this is probably the most studied PAH biomarker historically. And in general, it's frequently used as a surrogate measure of exposure to all PAH biomarkers. And in this case, there was something like a 2.8-fold difference between the subjects' levels of PAHs for 1-hydroxypyrene between the people that lived in the high levels, in the levels above the EPA cut point for sort of high levels of PM2.5, and the low levels. So that's a very significant increase. It's almost like three times the levels of PAHs for the people that lived in the high versus the low. And in comparing this to other reports, for example, the differences in 1-hydroxypyrene levels between smokers and non-smokers is pretty much the same. So it's somewhere around 250% higher, or so 2.5-fold difference in a person's biomarkers for 1-hydroxypyrene for between a smoker and a non-smoker. So at least with this one biomarker, it suggested that air pollution exposure may be a very significant contributor, at least to this one PAH. I don't know, it may not necessarily be true for all of them, but at least this one well-studied PAH, 1-hydroxypyrene, that the increase for people that live in high levels of air pollution was of a similar magnitude to being a smoker. So at least that may suggest that the exposure of air pollution can have very high levels, at least levels similar to being a smoker. So at least with our study, there are a variety of different limitations. I mean, at least from not just from sort of inherently sort of research methodology, are there limitations of it, but there were a lot of sort of limitations in what we could do because of going through the process of the RDC, the Research Data Center at the CDC. We basically have to travel to Atlanta in order to be able to do the analysis on their computers. And because of that, we felt we were sort of limited in types of analyses that we could do because, again, it's on their computers with their data and in a very limited amount of time. And it's quite expensive in order to go there and be able to do your analyses there. But again, with the NHANES study, I mean, this is all cross-sectional. So, I mean, I don't feel comfortable making any, that there's a slam dunk that the air pollution is causing cancer, or at least the types of things that PAHs have been known to do. But at least as with a lot of cross-sectional studies, it's hypothesis generating. So, there would be much better ways in order to do a study in order to try to measure these associations. But at least we felt like we were able to link this data and investigate some hypotheses, and we felt we were able to do that. And again, we're talking about PM2.5 levels around a person's place of residence. If they happen to work, the majority of their time away from home, that's more than 5 miles away from their home. This is obviously not a very good measure of a person's environmental exposure to PM2.5. And a lot of other studies have tried to use sort of personal monitors of PAH exposure. But again, this is what we were able to do. So there would be much better ways to try to investigate this further. And then, there were some issues, and again, we weren't able to delve into them too much, but with the EPA monitors, we weren't able to sort of investigate, again, because this is all done at the RDC, and it's trying to protect the NHANES subject's place of residence. We weren't able to see whether or not this was like a wide distribution of places across the nation. Again, NHANES is supposed to be representative of the U.S. population, but we weren't able to see, at least geographically, whether or not the people that were able to be linked in our data linkage were, you know, sort of equally distributed around the U.S. So, and then another thing, again, with our PAHs, again, as I mentioned in the beginning, humans are exposed to PAHs in a variety of different methods, occupational, air pollution, and then diet and tobacco smoke exposure. So we don't have complete data on the other routes of exposure. So a common criticism of at least this simple analysis was, you're not able to measure all different types of exposures to PAHs, and that's very true. But at least we're just trying to generate some hypotheses. So just to conclude, we did see some significant associations. In general, they were all very small between PM2.5 levels around subjects' residences and in individuals' levels of certain PAHs. So there may be associations between these. And then at least that the levels of PAHs, specifically the phenanthrene and the pyrene, were shown to be significantly elevated in non-smoking subjects who lived, or at least the day before, lived in areas where the average PM2.5 levels were above this EPA cut point. So basically, people that live in high levels or areas with high levels of PM2.5 exposure were found to have significantly elevated biomarkers of PAH exposure. And then lastly, just to conclude, I just wanted to thank everybody in our research group, and again, specifically on our funding, primarily the National Institute of Environmental Health Science, who's been nice enough to help me out since I've been a student, both in grad school and in medical school. And then this is just my research group. So that is pretty much it. Thank you.